For the week of November 17th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 469, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. At least I'm in New York for the moment.
Where will you be going when you're not in New York?
It's Thanksgiving. Next week will be Thanksgiving week, so I will be traveling down to Nashville, Tennessee to celebrate with my friends from college and some other friends joining us. And of course, while I'm ready to pull over on the side of the road, do what I must in order to keep the show going, you are too busy to do a show next week.
I had a feeling that's where that statement was going. I was like, somehow I have a feeling this is going to be a knock on me. And sure enough, that's exactly the direction it headed.
So no show next week.
No show next week.
Even though it's the biggest, well, we'll cover the box office the week after. That's when it will all happen. It's a big week for box office. It's a big week on TV where the impeachment hearings are reaching 13 million people a day, roughly. So that's a big hit. But I do want to make a correction before we jump into this week's show. Carole King is, in fact, in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but not as a performer. She is in as a songwriter, which is fair enough, though. In a way, she deserves to be in as a performer, too, since she has one of the best-selling albums of all time. But she is in as a songwriter. That's a different list. It's in a different area. So when I checked and double-checked and thought, how could she not be in the hall? Well, she is, just not in. It counts. It counts. She's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So that's good to know.
I just remember you saying that she wasn't. So I'm
We talked about it with Sal Nunziata last week, okay. And I've been listening to Thin Lizzy, a Spotify playlist he made for me. I'm really enjoying that. But you know, we got a lot going on this week. What are we going to talk about on this episode?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we try to tug on a thread. Yes, ooh. We're trying to understand the tangled mess of the Writers Guild and its showdown with agents. How streaming is taking over the world, and yet no one knows exactly how popular shows like Stranger Things are or how many viewers the show has. That's affecting guild negotiations, whether it's the Writers Guild, Directors Guild, and even the Screen Actors Guild. Those negotiations are with major studios and producers, and why all of this is tied together. It's all tied together, and since we've got more questions than answers, we'll be joined by our friend Jonathan Handel. He's a prominent entertainment industry attorney and a contributing editor to The Hollywood Reporter, where his latest article opened our eyes to all of these problems. On Inside Baseball, Michael takes issue with a post-mortem over the demise of the Broadway musical Tootsie. Michael Rydell of the New York Post has a host of reasons for why this critic's darling didn't click. Michael Gilt says it all comes down to one thing. And that is, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing, baby. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office from around the world for the last 7 days. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We pull information from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Deadline, Times, LA Times, New York Times, you name it. You are listeners. Info from China and India, which is a little sketchy this week. I think we're missing some movies. But nonetheless, we grabbed all the information we could, and the number one movie around the world last week is Ford versus Ferrari, the Matt Damon, Christian Bale drama about auto racing. It cost $100 million to make. It opened up worldwide. It made $52 million, did very well, overperformed in North America. It's in about 42 countries. And this is an adult film. This is not a movie people are going to rush out to. It's a very solid, promising start for a movie that should run and run and run.
You know, I actually tried to see this film over the weekend, but it was sold out several times.
Well, you know, the capacity, they can meet the demand, so there probably wasn't that much more demand. It's not like people were turned away. That just doesn't happen much, but it wasn't available the minute you wanted to see it, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, I was looking at specific showtimes.
And probably half an hour before, or like not 10 hours before.
No, probably about 3 or 4 hours before.
Though I am noticing in New York with the AMC passes that some of the screenings at one or two theaters, they sell out early in the day. I don't know if the people actually show up, but they book their tickets early. At number two around the world is Midway, the Roland Emmerich World War II drama that made $34 million. It's at $73 million and counting. We'll have to see where that ends up. At number three is Terminator Dark Fate. It made another $34 million. It's at $230 million and counting. That one probably will not be a success. But a big success is at number four. It's Joker. It made $32 million around the world. It passed the $1 billion mark. It has now grossed $1,016 million. Now, Sperling just told us he tried to see Ford versus Ferrari, but he promised to go see Joker and put it over the top. Sperling, did you do it? Did they have confetti? Did they give you a free Joker t-shirt? What happened?
They said, number 16's upstairs. There's a concession stand right outside.
So, did you go see the movie?
Yes, I did. Oh, and that's exactly what they said. Theater 16's upstairs. I was like, oh, okay, is that it? And the guy was like, he looked at me like, yeah, that's it.
A friend saw it who votes in the Emmys. I don't think she votes in the Oscars, but maybe she could. But she loved it. I was a little indifferent to it. What did you think?
You know, I can understand why people are indifferent to it. I could understand why people hate it, because it is not an easy movie. And it is, you know, it's definitely not.
What did you think?
I thought it was very, very good. I really liked the way the filmmaker kind of referenced other material, and the way he referenced that other material. And by other material, I'm talking Taxi Driver, I'm talking King of Comedy. There were several moments in the film that harkened back to other movies, and of course other stories, because it is an origin story. And I like the fact that he didn't take a straightforward action approach to it.
Action film. It's not a comic book movie. It's not an action film, not in the least.
Yeah.
But do you think, having seen it, it's kind of ugly and tough, do you think it's an Oscar hopeful for Best Picture? Because me, I saw this movie and I thought, I don't care what you think, this is not a movie that Oscar voters are going to take to heart.
Well, that I agree with. I think either you love it as a film, the way people like Taxi Driver, or
saying it, some people will like it and some people won't. I'm asking you, will it be nominated for Best Picture?
I believe it will.
Oh, you do?
I do think it will, yes.
It absolutely won't win.
No. It'll be nominated, and that's its award.
But it will be one of the rare, it's only be the second superhero movie of all time to be nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, you know, I would say this. I don't call it a superhero movie. That happens to be a movie that, yes, okay, is loosely tied to a superhero.
Not that loosely. He's the Joker. Batman world.
I know, but he may as well be called something else. It was a movie.
Travis Bickle?
Yes, it's basically a Travis Bickle.
All right, so Sperling has spoken. I don't think it will even get a nomination, though obviously there could be a core group of voters that could put it over the top just to get a nomination. People are passionate about it who do like it, so you have a good argument. At number five around the world is Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. That made $30 million. That's at $460 million and counting. So that one is going to be a wash. It's going to be okay, but clearly there will not be a Maleficent 3. At number six around the world is the big disappointment at the North American box office. It's Charlie's Angels. A big shrug for that long-running franchise. This new reboot made $28 million around the world. It only made $8 million in North America. It was really just nobody even cared. It's not like they rejected it. They just didn't even know or care that it was coming out.
I would kind of say, I don't know if it's a long-running franchise, because really—
It is, from the 70s.
Yeah, but
70s TV series, TV movies, a TV show reboots, two different movie reboots. Now this is the third movie, you know.
When was the last movie?
Well, this is a new reboot, but it doesn't matter. It's been around for decades. It's been around for decades. It's a perennial. Everybody knows Charlie's Angels.
I don't know. 18 years ago was the last movie.
Right. And 40 years ago was the TV show. That's what long running means. It's been around a long time. It doesn't mean it started last week. It means it's long running. Lots of hits, lots of iterations.
Okay. I don't know. The running part, I guess, is what I have an issue with, because I don't think it was running anywhere for the past 18 years. I think it was sitting on the bench.
That's why I'm a little surprised. They waited enough time so people might go, oh, hey, I'm happy to hear about Charlie's Angels again. It wasn't like the last movie came out 3 years ago. So that was sort of a positive thing.
Do you think it just opened on the wrong weekend that everybody
No, not at all. It's a movie that got poor reviews that people didn't like that, you know, it's no.
All right. You know.
The last film, by the way, was 2003, Charlie's Angels.
Yeah, 18 years ago. Yeah.
Though they also had a web series, an animated series spun off in 2003. So there you go.
Or
there
was 17 years before somebody writes it.
There was also a TV version in 2011. So they tried to reboot the TV show in 2011. That's 8 years ago. So, you know, it was long running. Not wildly successful, but there it is. Anyway, people are already saying, it's a flop, it's a disaster, it's the worst movie ever. It's the, you know, stupid overreaction online. It's only opened up in a third of its territories. It did make $30 million. It only cost $50 million to make. So give Elizabeth Banks a little credit. She helmed the film. She got it out there. Maybe it'll claw its way to 110 or 120. That's what I would expect. And maybe it'll do a little better overseas, though it did already open up in China and not do well there either. However, it cost $50 million and it's made $30 million on its opening week. It's got 2/3 of its territories left open. Hold your breath and wait to see where we end up. Clearly, it will not be a big hit, but this sucker may be saved by overseas. At number 7 is Last Christmas, the UK charming romantic comedy. $21 million it made last week. It's at $35 million and counting. Emma Thompson is hoping she gets to have the last laugh. At number 8 is Dr. Sleep, the sequel to The Shining. That made $19 million last week. It's at $53 million and counting. A lot of these movies are geared towards adults. Last Christmas, Dr. Sleep, certainly Ford versus Ferrari, and even Midway. So these movies could have a little better legs than you would normally expect. Even when they're not reviewed really well, some people like them. Some people are going, wait and see where they end up. That's the case with Playing with Fire, the John Cena comedy, and I'm putting comedy in quotes here. Hell, I'll even put John Cena in quotes. But this family-friendly comedy about firefighters and little tykes, it made $15 million last week. It's at $30 million worldwide. The Addams Family is at $167 million worldwide. And then we have another new film. It's called Somewhere Winter. It's a Chinese drama. It opened to about $13 million, so it made more money than Charlie's Angels in that territory. And I had no way to figure out what this movie is about. It looks like a drama. It's Chinese. But all I know is that the poster shows two lovers on a wintry road embracing in the middle of the road as a car comes around the corner. That's not safe, people. That's not good advice. Even if you're in love, cars can hurt when they hit you. But if you know what Somewhere Winter is about, because I could not figure it, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. And you can like our page on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
That's right. At number 12 is another Chinese drama, Better Days. That was the film that was banned and then unbanned and made another $10 million. It's at $212 million and counting. In Germany, Perfect Strangers is doing great. That's the remake of the Italian cell phone comedy. That made another $9 million. That's at $31 million worldwide. At number 14 is Zombieland 2, Double Tap. That made $9 million. Like a lot of those movies above this, people are going, eh, that didn't do well. That's a flop. That's not very good. Why did they make it? They made it because it's at $111 million worldwide. It cost about $40 million to make. So while nobody's excited by it, they did make money. And number 15 is Harriet. That made $8 million. That's really showing good legs in North America and elsewhere. That's at $31 million and counting. That Chinese comedy, My Dear Liar, about a dad, you know, romancing a cam girl, that made another $8 million. That's at $23 million worldwide. Now we have two more new movies. The Good Liar stars Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen, two of the best actors of all time. And yet it's not a very good movie. But it opened to $7 million.
Did you see this movie?
No, but it got poor reviews.
Okay, so, but you know, hey, see it for yourself.
Did you like it?
I didn't see it. Well, I'm
what
just
are you saying?
Saying?
Are you saying that it's...
I'm just saying it to be contradictory. How am I doing?
You're doing great. And number 18 is Black Money. This is a Korean thriller. It's about a prosecutor who uncovers a massive financial scandal. And so, of course, the powers that be make sure that he gets implicated in a scandal. So he has to clear his name and bring the criminals to justice and then make it home in time so he can vote for Elizabeth Warren. Anyway, it made $6 million on its opening week. And we'll have to see where that ends up. Jojo Rabbit. This movie's doing very well in North America as well. This expects to be an end-of-the-year guy appearing on lots of lists. It hopes to join Joker on the list of Best Picture nominees. It made $5 million this week. It's at $18 million and counting. It opens up almost everywhere in the world before Germany. In Germany, it opens up, I think, in April of 2020. So they're clearly hoping they can bring it to the home territory and say, look at what a big worldwide success it was. It got Oscar nominations. It got love all over the world. It's okay. You can laugh.
Yeah, or, you know, if you don't like it, there's something wrong with you.
Sure. The Divine Move 2, that's the Korean movie about the game of Go, as we call it. That's at $11 million. Parasite, another Korean film, doing great as well. That made another $4 million. That's at $118 million worldwide. I apologize to my friend, Reverend Andy. I sent him to the film. He said, should I go see that or Motherless Brooklyn with my wife? I said, clearly Parasite, one of the best films of the year, even though I didn't love it that way, but it's a big player. They went and found it too violent. So make a note, they really don't like violence because there's violence at the end, but, you know, it's not that violent of a movie. It ain't Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And rounding up the box office, I looked it up. I think I've got it right. This is a Turkish comedy Recep Ivedek. I hope I said that right, but it made $4 million. It's the sixth in a franchise. It's at $9 million and counting. Our lovable oafish hero tries to go to the city of Konya in Turkey, but he ends up in Kenya, Africa, and hilarity ensues along with a lot of racist stereotypes. I watched the entire trailer and I think I became dumber.
Why do you think you became dumber?
Because it's that dumb of and racist of a movie. It's just an embarrassment of a movie. It's just awful. I watched it. My IQ literally dropped as I watched it. It's like watching a, you know, not Adam Sandler. Who's the guy I want? The other one? Pauly Shore. It's like watching a Pauly Shore trailer. You just went, oh God. You know, it really was just awful looking. So that wraps up our worldwide box office. And I'll give you a little insight, Sperling. Pretty much everything we do on this show is inside baseball. We're such savvy insiders. Everything we say and do is inside baseball. So sometimes we say, should this go first? Should this go last? When we had Jonathan Handel scheduled, his timing worked out that we would bring him in the middle of the show. But he just told us, hey, I need a little delay. I got some stuff I'm doing, probably important stuff, unlike us. So we're going to move him to the end of the show, which means we're going to jump into inside baseball, do our coverage there about Tootsie, big deal, big whoop, and then we'll wrap up with Jonathan Handel when he's available.
Yes. So that is what we plan to do now. So, you know, inside baseball. Well, no, we'll just put him in inside baseball. That's what we'll do.
Right. Well, we called him one thing at the top. So, yeah, I'm just letting them know what's happening. We flip the stories. We usually have one to two features.
The Broadway musical Tootsie, which is closing. Mm-hmm. Right. That's well, you know, it's based on a hugely successful film, as you know, Michael. It got great reviews, the musical, that is. And yet it never caught on with audiences. I wanted to see it because it did get such good reviews. It's closing now at a loss, though, of course, producers hope touring and overseas productions will make it financially successful when all is said and done. Michael Rydell, a longtime Broadway gadfly over at The New York Post, he weighed in on what went wrong. Michael, to put it politely, he disagreed.
That's right. I feel like the other Michael, Michael Rydell, he should know better about some of the things he said. He occasionally contributes to the New York Post. He also has a regular radio show. That's his mainstay. But why don't you tell me what one of the first things that Michael said about the show or what he reported on, and I'll give you my response.
Well, since you called him a gadfly, I'll speak like I'm a gadfly. Tootsie, it's about showbiz, and shows about showbiz have a limited life. The Producers was the blockbuster hit of 2001, but ran a mere 6 weeks. The
Phantom of the Years.
Yes, 6 years. Oh, you're right, 6 years. The Phantom of the Opera and Wicked are still running. Okay, shows about showbiz are hard to sell, you're telling me, says Robert Horn, who won a Tony for writing the book to the musical, but I can't speak for the masses. I love going to the theater to see a show about the theater. Now, before you start, Michael, when I read this in our show notes, okay, I thought to myself, this paragraph makes no sense, and here's why. You're about to tell me.
Oh, well, why don't you tell me?
The Phantom of the Opera is about the Paris Opera, which is technically about show business.
It's absolutely about showbiz. That's right. The longest running show of all time is about showbiz. What else did you notice in that paragraph we pulled from his story, his column in the New York Post? He spoke to some of the people who worked on Tootsie, including Robert Horn, and he said a couple things there. What was the other big fact he mentioned in there?
That the producers ran for 6 years and actually ran here in Los Angeles for at least 6 months.
He said it ran a mere 6 years.
That's huge, isn't it?
That's insane. That makes it the 26th longest running show in all of Broadway history. Only 25 shows in the 100 plus years of Broadway have run longer than The Producers. The fact that he could even type a mere six, that's insane. That makes it one of the, that's like saying it only made $1.5 billion at the box office. Like, what are you talking about? That's just ridiculous. And as you said about The Phantom, that is about showbiz. The seventh longest running show of all time, A Chorus Line. That's about showbiz. Number 11, Rent, about artists struggling in New York. Also about showbiz. Number 12, Jersey Boys. Also about showbiz. Number 15, a revival of 42nd Street. Also about showbiz. In short, if you want a hit on Broadway, practically the best thing you can do is set it in showbiz. And The Producers is at number 26. Guess what's number 27? Beautiful, the Carole King musical. Also about showbiz. So that really was what set me off. A mere 6 years. That's insane. This guy wrote a book on Broadway history and some of the big producers. That is a nuttily wrong thing for him to say. But anyway.
Well, do you think, I mean, the Post, I mean, at least when I lived there, and I'm pretty sure still, is it's a Rupert Murdoch publication. It's being
He is responsible for his words. They did not change his words. No.
Okay.
No All way. Right.
Well,
no way.
No,
no,
well, I was
going to
head down the Fox News path and say, you know, on Fox News, they'll just say anything.
Shush.
Okay.
He is a longtime columnist. He writes his own columns. They don't change, you know, they're not putting facts in his mouth. No.
Well, he also said, Tootsie is a great title for people over 50, many of whom saw the movie when it came out in 1982, and they loved it. But a new generation is going to Broadway shows, and the kids who love Wicked and Mean Girls have never heard of Tootsie.
All right, well, screw you just for saying I'm old. Just because I saw the movie when it came out and I loved it. It's one of my favorite films of all time. I think it's the best film of that year, or certainly one of the two or three best. It's just a great movie. But Michael Rydell, to be fair, is not alone in thinking people don't remember Tootsie. However, the Broadway audience in general, despite the kids at Mean Girls and Wicked, it's still really, really old. You don't see lots of tykes at Broadway shows by and large. So just because you made a show that wasn't geared towards kids does not mean there's no audience for it. Tootsie grossed $177 million. That's equal to about $500 million in today's money. It got 10 Academy Award nominations. It's listed by the American Film Institute on their list of the best movies of all time, and it's number 2 on the best comedies of all time. But okay, so the show doesn't get the boost of name recognition maybe from people. That doesn't mean it's hurt by that lack of name recognition. Yes, it would help if people knew the movie, but it doesn't hurt that they don't. So that's not a slap against, you know, if you make a show based on a movie, you're hoping, well, that's a little extra boost, but it's not necessary. So in this case, if people don't know the movie, it's okay. That doesn't mean it should hurt the box office. It just isn't an extra reason why it would help.
Well, as the quick retort about being old, you know, Broadway is not cheap. So much like the quick retort to the OK Boomer, you know, it's like OK Millennials, but we're the ones with the money. You know, you could say, yeah, you geared a show toward the ones that actually pay.
For most, so, you know, who go to most Broadway shows, yeah.
Right. Rydell also said the kids are going to see Beetlejuice. Wait, what did I just do? Where is he? Nope, didn't work. Now, that's based on a more recent movie, of course.
That's right. And this is something we talk about in the box office all the time. Different shows are not really in competition. You could just as easily say the kids are going to go see David Byrne, so maybe they should have made a concert production. Or you could say the kids are going to see Hadestown, which they are, so an original musical is better than doing a movie musical. Instead, he said, well, you just should have made it on a more recent movie. That's shows succeed or fail on their own merit, not because they don't fit the formula of some other show that just became a hit.
Well, he went on to say, the time for Tootsie may have come and gone. It's about a self-centered guy who dresses up as a woman to take a job from a woman, says one source on the show. 3 years ago, it would have been hilarious. Today, I'm not so sure.
Okay, this complaint drives me bonkers, and people have been saying this since the show began. People, in fact, the show itself, the creatives on this show, thought the film Tootsie needed fixing.
What?
The film is about a guy coming to better appreciate the sexual harassment and double standards that women face every single day. He's always seen himself as treated unfairly, but pretending to be a woman gives him a new perspective and teaches him the useful tools women are forced to make use of just in order to accomplish the things they do without immediately being painted as demanding or a bitch. Thinking it reinforces sexism is like thinking the movie Arthur celebrates alcoholism. No, it doesn't. So when they told me this show needs fixing, this movie's got problems, it doesn't play well today, I'm thinking, what movie are you watching? Because that is crazy. That's what made Tootsie a good idea, because it works so perfectly for today. Are there things to tweak? Of course, I'm sure. But nonetheless, that's a crazy thing to say and shows a complete misunderstanding of the movie.
As one Tony voter who
this
voted
This is Michael
for,
Rydell talking again.
Yes. Well, yeah. When I talk, think of Michael Rydell. Or do I need to do it in a gadfly voice?
Please no.
Okay. As one Tony voter who voted for Tootsie as Best Musical says, and this is a quote of that Tony voter, it's very satisfying as a comedy, but not very satisfying as a musical. What he means is that Yazbek's score doesn't quite reach the heights of Richard Rodgers or Andrew Lloyd Webber. Yazbek wrote funny, sophisticated songs, but what's missing is a melody you can latch onto, a melody such as Some Enchanted Evening, or memory?
Yes, why didn't you write one of the greatest hits of all time? You should have done that. Good advice. Well, yes, but bingo. There, he's right. This is a musical, and most of the songs aren't good. As I said in my brilliantly titled review, Tootsie is a drag. So we have a link to my review in the show notes. Sperling should not have wanted to go see the show because I didn't recommend it. But that's okay, Sperling. You know, you go whatever. But, you know, it's not a big deal that he, you know, defended he likes the show more than I did. I don't agree with everything. But yeah, when it comes to a musical on Broadway, the songs are first. You can have a weak book and everything else. If you got great songs, that's all that matters.
Well, it was a big deal. Didn't the lead performer win the Tony?
Santino Fontana. Yes, but that doesn't pack them in necessarily. You know, the only award that really matters in that sense is usually winning Best Musical or Best Musical Revival and, of course, doing a great performance on the show. And I don't think they chose the right, you know, because there are no good songs in the show. So it was hard to choose the right performance. You know, you couldn't pick one that would wow them because there aren't a lot of good songs.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess if that's not a big deal, maybe some of the stories in our Big Deal or Big Whoop segment will turn you on. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, in fact, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story. A movie's box office gross, as we all know, can be one of its best advertisements. People like winners, and when movies gross a lot on just a few screens, it piques everyone's interest and gives the media a positive story to sell. But when the people behind a movie don't care about box office, why divulge info that can just make you look bad? So Netflix will play dumb on Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. Maybe not such a dumb thing, so a 3.5-hour quiet drama might not pack him in. You know, the box office might not be so huge. That could only hurt its Oscar chances, and more importantly, make it seem less appealing when it debuts on Netflix on the 26th of November. Now Amazon is taking a page out of that playbook. When it rents out theaters to display some of its Oscar hopefuls without actually releasing them commercially, Amazon is going to keep its box office to itself. And we mean that both figuratively and literally. We'll explain.
That also means
no opening weekend numbers to boast about for Adam Driver's drama, The Report. Hey, that's no different, by the way, from Adam Driver's Marriage Story, which Netflix released. The same is true for Amazon's The Aeronauts and other films. They'll decide on a case-by-case basis whether to fess up, Big Deal or Big Whoop.
Well, as you were explaining, these movies are being four-walled in these cases, which means they rent out the theater and they get to keep all the box office. So all the money goes to them because they're just renting out the space and taking all the risk.
Correct. They're right. Basically saying, how much would you have made on your average week for that? I want to rent theater number 3. How much for the entire week? And I get 100% of the box office.
Right.
And by the way, you don't report the box office to anybody.
Right. So Amazon and Netflix are going to do this on a case-by-case basis. I don't know if Netflix is ever going to release a movie commercially, but maybe they will. Amazon has in the past, and it paid off. Manchester by the Sea cost $9 million to make, ran in theaters for 23 weeks, and grossed $47 million in North America alone. I think it made like $75 million worldwide. Plus, it won 2 Oscars. I'm betting that increased its value in the Amazon library. So there is a positive to box office and making that run for the Oscar. But, you know, the movies they're talking about, The Report, it looks noble but dull. That's not going to pack them in. The Aeronauts, that's kind of getting poor reviews. What's the advantage of taking stuff you don't think will work commercially and giving them a big run and letting people know the box office? Nothing. So they're giving them prestige little platform runs, making them Oscar eligible, keeping the filmmakers happy, but not bothering to release the box office. In my mind, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, you know, I think that certainly Netflix cracked the window on this, no pun intended, in that they kind of said, okay, well, we're not going to release box office, and the studios, yeah, they're throwing a fit, but there's not much they can do about it. So Amazon said, you know what? We'll do the same thing as too, because in situations such as Late Night, for instance, the Mindy Kaling movie with I'm totally blanking.
Emma Thompson.
It didn't do well, even though it was a great movie. It was picked up for a lot of money and then wound up making no money at the box office. I would say that Amazon is having trouble actually releasing films. They don't know what they're doing on their own. Because if you go back to Manchester by the Sea, that was not a movie they released. Yes, it was their movie. They themselves didn't release it.
Right. I was had my microphone on mute because there's sirens outside. So, yeah, they need a better job of distribution. But I do think Late Night was the sort of movie that did want and need a commercial release. There was no reason not to release that commercially. I would have thought you could make money on that and give a better glow to the film. It just didn't work out.
Yes, I agree. I was a little surprised that they were releasing it in summer. I was a little surprised at the way they released it.
Counter-programming, if it worked, you know.
Yeah, if it worked.
They just didn't have the right players. They don't have the right team in place yet. It's a tricky thing to learn how to distribute films and get good slots and get good theaters and know when and how to do it. So they're learning on the go.
Correct. Now, China feels attacked on all sides. Animated films won't show their made-up maps rejected by the world community. Maps whose borders they are afraid to contest in international venues. Video game players object to China's crackdown on freedom in Hong Kong. And now Sweden is honoring Chinese writers with literary prizes. And not just any writer. Chinese writer Gui Minha is a naturalized Swede and owned a bookstore in Hong Kong. He won the Tucholsky Literary Prize. Gui won't be there to claim it because that writer was seized by the Chinese government while traveling with Swedish diplomats. Traveling in China, I might add. They're being held in detention, so an empty seat was kept open at the ceremony. Swedish Prime Minister Stefan Löfven said the country, quote, would never cave in to this kind of threat. Never. We have freedom of speech in Sweden, and that is the point. Period. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, it's a big deal. It's nice of Sweden. No, I'm sorry. It's a big whoop. This is how you do and should treat China when you're talking about stuff in your own country. They don't like it. Who cares? It just makes them look bad and stupid when they bitch and complain. I'm sorry. I've said bitch twice today. I don't mean to curse. I'm sorry. But, you know, it makes them look bad and enfeebled and weak when they complain about another country giving a literary award to one of their, you know, own citizens. That just makes China look feckless. I mean, meanwhile, right now, we're looking at video of them attacking.
Wait, China actually complained about this? Why would they even care?
That's what the whole story is about.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
I thought that they were just saying.
No, they absolutely complained. The people behind the show said we were a little surprised. We knew they wouldn't like it, but we didn't think they'd actually make a fuss. But they said, you shouldn't give him this award. He's not going to come. You know, we talked about this guy being grabbed years ago when this first happened. And they're cracked down on bookstores in Hong Kong. And now we see them cracking down on the entire citizenry. College students being beaten and attacked and firebombed. And, you know, literally the city on fire. It's very sad. My dad lived there for a decade. So it's very sad to see. But when you're talking about you've got a video game player on your video game platform saying something tough, you just tell you don't. You just like, sorry, we're not giving up our free speech in this country. You don't want to have our video games in your country. Knock yourself out. That's what you have to do. And they will realize how weak they are. And either they're going to want that stuff in their country or they're going to pay the price by isolating themselves.
Well, the ratings are finally in.
Woo!
The TV season began over a month ago. And now we can tell you the big winners from the first week of new and returning shows. That's right. We have up to the month news. These are just the shows airing on the broadcast networks ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and the CW. And by the way, it includes the live plus 35 info, which is why we are so late, because it means Nielsen adds up all those
people. We had to wait a month
people.
Before they could,
so
they could watch it. It's not late.
Right.
This is it. It's all.
And you'll see why we did this in just a moment. Nielsen, they added up all those people who watched live, all those people who then watched during the first 35 days on their DVR, and of course, on demand. Looking at those numbers, NCIS is the number one show after 35 days with 18 million viewers. And This Is Us is number two with 14 million. But wait, add in multi-platform viewing, and This Is Us hits 19 million viewers, and NCIS, well, that doesn't have any multi-platform numbers because we're still trying to explain to Grandpa what multi-platform means. He just wants to watch NCIS. That's it, people. Just get out of his way. Those extra eyeballs add up, by the way. Grey's Anatomy is just the 23rd ranked show after 1 month, but toss in multi-platform, and it jumps from 10 million to 16 million and third overall. CBS? Yeah, they really don't like those multi-platform numbers, and that's because they don't have any. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, there's a big change up in who's watching what. It's another indication that viewing patterns have changed forever. I'm watching Insecure. I'm on the season one of Insecure, episode 6. I also just finished the HBO miniseries Chernobyl. Right.
Okay.
I'm also on top of some current shows, but this is how people consume television now. They're not doing it when you want to. And there's no reason not to at least keep a running update of who the big shows are for Live Plus 35, since that's when a lot of people are accessing them. And hey, if anybody's got numbers for 1 week of the television season, the Live Plus 35 for everything, cable, network, premium cable, syndicated, for the love of God, you know, leak it to us so we can do a chart of the big 100 shows. I don't care whether it's late night TV, the Today Show, Judge Judy. I would love to see a chart of just the 100 biggest shows of a week ranked by total viewers. I would love to do that. I think that's what they need to do to promote television, and they're not doing it.
Well, I can tell you what the number one show last week was. Does what? That help? The impeachment hearings.
that may not have been, but football took a big hit this week. The Sunday Night Football went down 30% from 1 week earlier. Not quite sure why.
Ooh. Maybe it was a poor helmet bashing incident.
Yeah. Oh, that was ugly. Yeah, that was awful.
Last week, Leonardo da Vinci added a mustache to the Mona Lisa.
What?
Yeah, he did. Beethoven, by the way, removed the Ode to Joy fourth movement. Yeah, he did that from his Ninth Symphony. He did that last week, too.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and George Lucas has effed with Star Wars yet again.
George.
Some people like Martin Scorsese might laugh at the idea of linking Star Wars to those towering achievements like the Mona Lisa. Yet others are shaking their heads and wondering what has happened to Han Solo. In the original film, Solo faced down a bounty hunter and shot the guy in cold blood. In the special edition, Lucas softened that by having the bounty hunter shoot first so that Solo is defending himself. Like Gene Autry in those old westerns, this Solo would not draw his gun first, never. And now, the latest version of Star Wars on Disney Plus has a new scene. Solo doesn't shoot first. The bounty hunter doesn't shoot first. They both shoot at the same time. And the bounty hunter dies, exclaiming, "McClunky!" as he gasps his last breath.
McClunky.
Big deal or big whoop. I don't know. By the way, audience, listen, I don't get that joke.
Nobody knows. It's not a joke. Nobody gets it. Why he says McClunky? He seems to
McClunky?
He says McClunky. And everybody's like, why does he say McClunky? What does that possibly mean? He actually goes, "Oh, McClunky." It's insane. I'm fine. You want to have them both shoot at the same time? You want a black and white Star Wars? You want a 3D Star Wars? You want a 9-hour cut of Star Wars? Not only am I fine with you doing that, I will line up to see it because I'm that much of an idiot. But for the love of God, don't change history. Allow the original edition available. When you've got Blu-ray or you've got streaming, the ability to make multiple versions of a film available is so easy and simple. Put up the original edition and fully restored, and the special edition, and any new edition you want. Go crazy, but do not erase history. Please make the original version of every film available. The Last Picture Show, he's tweaked that. Once Upon a Time in America, the director's cut is infinitely better, but you should have both versions available. The Cotton Club, same thing. Stop, you know, mess with your movies all you want. Just do not refuse to let us see the original film that was released.
Well, in the case of Blade Runner, Ridley Scott did not want the voiceover narration.
That's right, but that version should still be available, and that's much less preferable to the other versions he's done. I forget whether it's version 3 or 4 that is the best one, but that's fine. Absolutely, I understand that, but the original version that became acclaimed and had an impact originally was years before anybody could see any other version. That should be available so we can see the travesty and the silliness of it. You know it makes me want to say McClunky.
Harrison Ford said, but you know, he's always been faulted for the monotone narration that he gives. He said, I was trying to tank the reed so that they wouldn't use it.
Absolutely. Yeah, everybody knows that. Of course. More power to him.
The upcoming season of American Crime Story is tackling the Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky scandal. I don't know how that's a crime story, but anyway. And they just found...
It was a trial.
Yeah. They just found their president, by the way. Actor Clive Owen will play the cigar-loving 42nd leader of the United States. As our co-host, Karen Woodward, used to love to say, man gets job, or in this case, actor gets job. Big whoop. But in the announcement, series creator Ryan Murphy announced the season scheduled to drop just as the 2020 presidential election nears may get bumped. He says because of casting and legal vetting, the dates for when the show will air are a little tentative. As our 42nd president would have said, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I didn't know I was co-hosting with Rich Little. However, I will say it's a big whoop. I don't want to overplay what sort of impact this would have if it played before the election. I remember back when The Right Stuff came out and people were freaked out a little bit that that movie about the space race might make John Glenn president. You know, it was going to so lionize him that he was going to be able to become president. It was unfair. So, you know, yeah, maybe this American Crime Story wouldn't, you know, tilt the election, but it's just so cynical and hateful of them to do it right before the election. It's so obnoxious. They should wait till the spring. Clearly they're going to, but they're just too much of a jerk to say, yeah, we were wrong. They're not going to use some lame excuse like, well, we just, you know, we're busy, so we'll do it later. So I hope they do, but just fess up and say you were wrong and do it.
Well, you know who else said, about John Glenn becoming president? Ronald Reagan, because he won.
He certainly did.
Boy, you really need to know your Ronald Reagan to get that joke. The new owners, by the way, of Taylor Swift's catalog are playing hardball, although this was just
I've updated it.
Okay. In 2020, Swift will have the right to perform her old songs in any context, give rights permissions, and re-record those tracks if she wants to. And Swift wants to, since she was blocked from buying the rights to her classic songs and chose not to be sold off to the highest bidder when her contract was up, and she knew her old company, and thus Taylor herself, would soon be up for sale. As you may remember, not only did her old label refuse to let Swift buy back her back catalog, it sold the label to manager Scooter Braun, an executive Swift had a long unpleasant history with. Knowing that she is playing hardball, they are doing the same. Swift is getting an Artist of the Decade Award at the AMAs and wanted to do a medley of all her big hits. They refused to give permission, and that is Scooter Braun's record label there, and they refused to give permission unless she agreed to a string of demands. They're also refusing to give song usage permission for a Netflix doc unless she agrees never to badmouth them again. As Swift puts it, they want her to be a good little girl and shut up. Instead, she went public. They released a statement saying she was full of it. And she said, yeah, full of great music. Swift, in turn, detailed some of the requirements they attached to her performance. Oh, and she says they owe her $8 million. So at the last minute, by the way, a deal was struck with ABC releasing a statement saying everyone had agreed and Big Machine surely insisted. ABC says artists...
There's a clause in the statement where Big Machine says, in the statement, ABC says, and of course, artists don't need label permission to perform their own songs.
Yeah, they don't.
But they really do need permission if it's going to be rebroadcast or replayed in any way, shape, or form. Because if she wanted to put it up on YouTube and get all the hits and the money, well, then she didn't have permission to have her AMA medley, you know, be done. So she wouldn't have been able to profit from it in other ways. Plus, they wanted her to agree never to badmouth them, give up the claim that they owed her $8 million in royalties and all this other stuff. So
did she agree to that?
No. All they agreed to was that it would be on the air, that she could perform it. However, I don't believe she got all the retransmission rights that she wanted, but she did get the chance to do it on the air without having to agree to all their other ridiculous demands that they wanted her to just promise never again to say anything negative about them. So, you know, on the other hand, I'm not a big fan of celebrities sicking people onto other people. So Taylor Swift telling her fans to reach out to them and the investment firm, I don't like that. That's not the way to do business. It's an ugly, ugly fight. I think she mostly was in the right here, but, you know, sicking a swarm of social media people, that's not a good way to go.
Yeah, no, and all she really had to say was, this is what's going on, and they would have done that anyway.
Right, but she should also not use names and not tell people to reach out to them.
That's what I'm saying. She didn't need to say that part. But, that would have happened naturally.
She should also encourage people not to reach out to them and not to berate them online and things like that. So not only, she should actively not have her fans do things like that. Anyway.
Well, speaking of people who are being active, mm-hmm. Netflix offered the comic star Monique $500,000 to do a comedy special for the streamer. But she's not laughing. No, Monique made a counteroffer, suggested Netflix was being discriminatory, and when that didn't do the trick, she filed a lawsuit. Monique previously suggested a boycott on Netflix, and now she's taking them to court, claiming its offer of $500,000 constitutes both gender and racial discrimination. Monique pointed to the tens of millions offered to male comics, the way Amy Schumer pushed for more money and got it when she said her offer was too low. And then Monique finished off her complaint by including photos of the all-male, all-white top execs at Netflix. Wanda Sykes chimed in with support, saying she turned down a special when their offer to her was about half of what Monique was offered. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It's a very challenging case to win, obviously. Amy Schumer was offered $11 million, and you can say Amy Schumer's a much bigger star, but she was offered $500,000. That is a shockingly low ball number. Monique is a big star. She's got a big audience. She's on TV specials all the time. She is a draw, and I'm sure she's worth more than $500,000 when these other people are getting tens of millions of dollars. That is suspicious. You're telling Wanda Sykes, we'll give you $250,000? That's insanely...
Well, but in all fairness, Wanda Sykes is not nearly the draw that someone like Amy Schumer
right.
or Dave Chappelle...
So she should only get $2 million or $3 million or $4 million. One-tenth, one-half, one-fifth, not one-one-hundredth. No, those numbers are insanely low-balled. Insanely. That's, you know, saying, well, they're not as big a star. But that's why it's going to be a hard case to prove. They don't have to give her a contract to anything. They don't have to make a deal with her. They can offer what they want. But you look at those numbers and hear her being public about what she was paid, that is eyebrow raising. Absolutely. This is what happens. People do the same work that, you know, they won't tell you the numbers of even how many people you draw. How can she compare to how her last special did? When they won't even tell you how you did. For all you know, she's making twice the audience of the last special by Amy Schumer, but they wouldn't tell you. So, you know, you're in the dark. You don't know what's going on. But one great way to clear things up is to tell people what you're getting paid. Because then your coworkers and your boss doesn't want you to do it. But guess what? Everybody else benefits. And you say, what? I do the same work as him. How come he's getting twice as much? Well, he's got a family to take care of. This is the crap they've always said. No, this is BS.
I have no problem. I have no problem telling people how much we're being paid. It's
nothing,
zero.
Nothing. Yeah, no, yeah. Monique has a case. Don't tell me, well, Chris Rock is about. Yes, he is. That's why he's getting, you know, $20 million. But her $500,000? That's crazy.
The Academy Awards may not know the Best Picture nominees yet. Okay, they don't. But it does know who's going to produce the TV show. That would be Lynette Howell Taylor, who produced last year's Oscar winner and Best Picture nominee A Star Is Born, and Stephanie Elaine, who has been key in supporting the careers of John Singleton and Robert Rodriguez, among many others. Elaine also, and I know some people pronounce it Alan, but Elaine is how I've always knew to pronounce it. She also oversaw the film and TV series Dear White People, and directed the LA Film Festival from 2011 to 2016. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I hope it's a big deal, and I hope they do a good job. It's two women, one woman of color. Very cool. They're prominent producers. They're ready to take on the Academy Awards. Lynette Howell Taylor also did Half Nelson, a key film for Ryan Gosling, a very good movie. And she's got an upcoming fictional account of Marlon Brando, how he did Last Tango in Paris. That's going to be a tricky one to pull off. However, if you look at all their credits, and as far as I can tell, there is no live TV for either of them. And that's what this is. This is a live television show. I'd like to believe I could produce the Academy Awards. Great. And I could if I had full permission to do whatever I wanted. The problem is everything is a negotiation. Every guild, every person, every group has their own demands. And you don't get to just do what you want or think is best for the show. So I know they're in a difficult position, but it sure helps to be good at live television. And that is what they are sorely lacking. So I don't care, man, woman, or child. You really should be an expert in live TV.
Well, I agree with you, and I think the reason that they pick these producers is because they have deep ties and can get stars to show up. Frankly, I think that's silly.
That's BS because
it's
you're
the Oscars.
Yeah, when I was interviewing for a job at a trade journal, they said, well, what are your contacts? Who do you know? I'm like, if I pick up the phone and say I'm calling from, you know, the Hollywood Reporter Variety, I'm pretty sure people will get on the line. Like, what do you mean?
Well, yes.
That, I got to bring all my Rolodex
said,
here?
They,
give me a break.
Well, no, but they want to know. Yeah, they might get on the line.
It was an entry level thing, for the love of God. It wasn't like they were hiring me to, you know, come on. This was when I was a kid.
I just wonder if Lynette Howell Taylor will. You know, since she's working on this Brando thing, when she reaches out to people for the Oscars, whether she'll say, I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse.
There you go. Stephanie Elaine or Alan also did Hustle and Flow and Beyond the Lights. They both got some really good credits rooting for them. But I wish they were producers, male or female, who had TV, live TV credentials.
I think they really leave that to the director, you know, to really form that. But I agree with you.
Yeah.
The Emmys are taking action, though, to make sure the people who vote are the people who actually, you know, work in the industry. To take part in the Emmys, members must be active. It varies from guild to guild, but this usually means multiple credits within the last 4 years. And no, retirees won't be getting the boot, okay? So if you've been around for 20 or more years and would have qualified in 16 of those years to vote, you'll be a legacy member and get lifetime voting privileges. Thank goodness, because no one wants to lose free access to Disney Plus just as voting season begins. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's hopefully a big whoop, and they're just really trying to get rid of some really egregious members who vote and like have one TV credit from 20 years ago. You know, that's hopefully right. What they're focusing on, not trying to get rid of old people, not trying to do this or that. You know, you want to make sure they're active or regular or have careers and legacies that make them eligible to vote for the Emmys. So, you know, I hope they err on the side of caution rather than cutting people out. But, you know, you got one credit from 18 years ago. I'm sorry, you think you should be voting for the Emmys, but it ain't going to cut it.
The Latin Grammys announced their big winners, and many of Latin's top stars are not pleased. Why, you may ask? It's because, just like the Grammys proper, the Latin Grammys are hopelessly out of touch when it comes to the big hot acts and the defining genre of the era, reggaeton.
Reggaeton. They might
make reggaeton. You know what? I actually looked it up. I heard it pronounced both ways, and so I'll go with reggaeton since you like that one. Look at the YouTube charts, people. The best demonstration of what's popular all over the world. The top three songs, reggaeton. 10 of the top 25, reggaeton. On Spotify, 11 of the top 50 acts are reggaeton. And at the Latin Grammys, reggaeton acts can barely get nominated outside of the urban pop genre. Instead, the top songs and album nominees feature acts a little long in the tooth and past their prime. Legends, yes, but people 45 and older like Juanes, Marc Anthony, and Alejandro Sanz. Thank you for calling me long in the tooth, by the way. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, reggaeton acts like Bad Bunny are asked to perform but have no chance at a big prize. Is this all a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop because it's an awards show and what happens, happens. And Latin Grammys have an even harder job than the regular Grammys, or, you know, I don't know what to call them, the Grammys proper, the big boys. The Latin Grammys field music from 20 countries. And the audience of native speakers around the world, native Spanish speakers, that's bigger than the native English language speakers. 480 million people around the world speak Spanish as their first language. Only 380 million people speak English. So you've got people from, you know, Venezuela who listen to different music than people in Cuba, who listen to different music than people in Spain, who listen to different music from people in Mexico. So it's not easy. It's a big challenge, but they really need more members to vote and take part. They really have got to work on activating the groups and artists that are active and making the big noise right now. And, you know, you can't complain if you don't vote and you don't try to stay active and be on boards and stuff. And hopefully that's what some of the top artists who are active today are realizing. And they're going to, instead of just, you know, saying this sucks, they're going to take part in the Latin Grammys and make it better. But it's like the Grammys. The whole point of the Grammys was to, like, keep out rock and roll. They wanted to recognize real music. Their whole purpose of being is to embrace the old fuddy-duddies and ignore the new. So it's kind of built into their DNA.
Paramount Pictures may not have its own streaming service yet, but it does have something it hasn't had in a while. Profits! The film and TV studio posted income for the last fiscal year, which is a nice change of pace. Its parent company Viacom is merging with CBS, so they'll soon be one big happy family again, combining a TV network, the CBS All Access streamer that Grandpa can't find, cable channels like MTV and Nickelodeon, and Paramount Pictures with its Star Trek and Mission Impossible franchises. Oh, and apparently Paramount does have a streamer called Pluto. Like NBC's upcoming Peacock, it's free but comes with ads, and Paramount says it has 20 million users so far, so big deal or big whoop.
Well, it's a big deal. It's always good to have a profit, especially when you haven't had one for a few years. Who the heck has heard of Pluto? Not me.
I have, but barely. Now, what to do about Dumbo and a ton of other cartoons and movies that contain, you know, racist stereotypes and other material many would find objectionable? In the case of the Oscar-winning film Song of the South, remember that movie, mm-hmm. Michael? Yeah, Disney pretends it never existed. Actually, Disney says, we don't remember that. Song of the what? No, we don't know what
you're talking
about.
Never heard of it. Keep moving.
When it comes to the racist black crows in Dumbo, or ugly stereotypes in Peter Pan and the Aristocats, and numerous other examples, Disney inserts two warnings. A disclaimer pops up, letting you know the work you are about to watch contains dated stereotypes. And when necessary, a fuller explanation appears right before the content starts. That statement ends with this sentence. While these cartoons do not represent today's society, they are being presented as they were originally created, because to do otherwise would be the same as claiming these prejudices never existed. That is a sentence that is not meant to be read out loud. Trust me, that's a tongue twister. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I think it was the right choice. I think the sentiment and the statement that they put in front of these is pretty much perfect and spot on in terms of saying, yes, they're ugly, but we don't want to try and pretend they never happened. Here they are, giving you a little warning. So I think that's, you know, about exactly what they should do. So, you know, there are some people and groups saying there should be a warning in front of Aladdin because that has some stereotypes they don't like, and Pocahontas. But by and large, I think they nailed it.
Well, Michael, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, as promised, we're going to be talking to entertainment and technology attorney at Troy Gould and, by the way, a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter, Jonathan Handel. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Well, just as we're starting here, apparently Abrams Artists Agency, a talent agency in the entertainment business here, they have broken with the ATA, the Association of Talent Agents, and they've signed the code of conduct with the WGA. This has been a story we've been talking about, this whole WGA firing their agents. This story we've been talking about for months. So what does all of that mean?
Right. It's the third mid-tier agency to sign with the WGA and their new standards. And of course, once they're negotiating, they worked out some new changes and tweaks they wanted, which the WGA said all along was what would happen. They said their stance was not written in stone. They expected to negotiate and work it all out. It's just another mid-tier company. It doesn't really signal a breaking in the wall until one of the big ones falls. Or is this meaningful?
Well, it's meaningful. It as a reminder to everybody, back in April, over 7,000 writers fired their agents. Many or most of them at the largest agencies, the four largest, which would be WME, CAA, UTA, and ICM Partners, but also at mid-tier agencies and smaller agencies. And as you've noted, some of the mid-tier agencies have broken ranks. There also were a couple of small to mid-tier agencies that are non-ATA members that have signed with the Writers Guild. And the issue that they, for all of them, has been really, it's really been threefold. Affiliate production, which is the practice the three largest agencies have of having affiliated production companies that create content, actually in business as producers. Packaging fees, which is something that affects the four largest agencies, plus to some extent several of the mid-tier agencies like Paradigm and APA. And that's a practice where the agencies get paid by the studios rather than collecting commissions from their own clients. And neither of those affect an agency like Abrams particularly. But what does affect Abrams is a third issue, which is what the Writers Guild considers information sharing, namely that whenever a writer who is a member of the Writers Guild and a client of one of these agencies enters into a contract with a studio, that the Writers Guild wants a copy of that contract. They want that, they say, in order to get a better handle on the industry and on industry trends. It's also the case that enables them to collect dues more efficiently. Writers are supposed to be turning in those contracts themselves, but often don't. And the Writers Guild is trying to muscle the agencies into effectively being cops on the beat for the Writers Guild in that information sharing exercise. So what Abrams was able to negotiate was, some changes in the degree of information sharing and exactly how that would work, and really kind of down in the weeds. But that's the issue for the mid-tiers. If you get more mid-tier agencies like a Paradigm or an APA signing on, there will be pressure, particularly on probably particularly on ICM, which does not engage in affiliate production, to reconsider whether it wants to break ranks as well. So it's been a long siege warfare now. I mean, it's been 7 months since April, And the fight has been going on a few months, you know, before that as well, with negotiations. And, you know, the Writers Guild is also locked in litigation against and the three largest agencies, and those three largest have also sued the Writers Guild. So it's a very complex and difficult situation.
Well, you know, ICM Partners doesn't engage in affiliate productions, but certainly they package,
right,
and they package television shows. And there is some news that there's some packaging going on. The agents are packaging shows without writers attached. They're leaning on pre-existing properties like podcasts and books and things that, you know, might not need a writer there, but there are no writers attached. So that's a big change really from typical practices.
Those things do need writers, you're right. It's a huge change, but the way it plays out is this: in the past, if an agency saw a book or a podcast or sometimes a magazine article that it thought, gee, that would make a good movie or television series or one season television series, whatever it might be, they would package that together with a writer and probably with a star, perhaps with a director, and take that package to market. Now they're doing exactly the same thing, except without the writer. The writer, though, you know, the scripts don't write themselves, and podcasts and books don't magically turn into movies or TV series by themselves. What happens is, the project gets sold to a buyer, and then the buyer puts out an open assignment for a writer, and the writer gets hired on as a hired hand, making less money than they would have otherwise, and having probably less creative control than they would have otherwise if they'd been part of the package from the beginning. So the Writers Guild move here to prohibit packaging of writers has, it appears, been to the detriment in this instance of writers. And the Writers Guild would not have the ability to prevent agencies from packaging, you know, from engaging in packaging without the writer. That's right, because it's outside of Writers Guild jurisdiction.
Right. And that's actually, you know, when I worked at agencies and CA and William Morris among them, that's exactly how, you know, you would go and create films and in some instances, TV shows, but mostly films. You would either have an idea or a script. Obviously, a script has a writer, so let's put that aside for a second. But if you had a magazine article or a book, this happened all the time. Scott Rudin or a producer would buy the rights to a book, usually with a studio. It would then become an open writing assignment, and it would be shopped out to agencies who could then pitch their writers to be a part of the movie.
That's right. But and now what's happening is that because writers are not available to be packaged, having quit their agencies, at least as far as their writing services go, they are, you know, the Writers Guild has pushed the marketplace more in this direction, the direction you just described.
But I mean, if you're a big in-demand writer and they want you for this project, you're still going to be able to say, hey, I want my quote, my fees, my participation. I expect, you know.
But with packaging, you get back end and you're
Well, but really you'll still be able to demand that. It's not like you can't get it, right? If you're a big writer that they want, if you're a nobody, of course they can get you and make you take whatever. But if you're a big name writer, you know, they're not going to suddenly be able to get you for $5 an hour.
Yeah, except you're presenting it as an all or nothing, that either you're a nobody and you take what you're given, or right, you're a somebody and you get exactly what you want. It's not a binary. It's not a binary choice. The issue is that this reduces the leverage, even of fairly big writers, and anecdotally, we are told, and there are no, you know, surveys out there, obviously, but anecdotally, we are told that writers are faring. It's not that they're having to accept whatever the studio wants to cram down, but that they may not be getting quite as much as they would have otherwise in terms of creative control or compensation, either perhaps on the front end or on the back end. And in many cases, it's not just, well, we have to have, you know, Jane Smith or the whole project collapses. It's like, we want Jane Smith, but you know what? John Doe is also a pretty good writer, and Stephen Willers is a good one, and Mary Doe did a good job on this last project. So if Jane Smith proves to be to want too much, we've got other writers that we can prospects that we can go to.
I assume it was always that way, though, of course, you know. This brings us to an article in the Hollywood Reporter. As we all know.
As a matter of fact, your article in the Hollywood Reporter.
Well, that's the story. Brings us to an article in the Hollywood Reporter. As we know, streamers do not share information about how successful and popular their shows are unless they choose to, with some very mysterious metrics. Nobody's looking over their shoulder. So it's kind of a black box. And the headline to this article is Streaming TV's Ratings Black Box Could Lead to Hollywood Guild War. I was immediately intrigued. I dove into the story. I thought, wow, this is great. We should have the journalist on the show to talk about this. Wow, this is really, and this is fascinating. You know, Jonathan Handel, I literally thought he'd be a great guy to really good perspective. Oh, he wrote the article. That was literally how it went. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us about the article you wrote.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that. It's always nice to be rediscovered.
Every time there's a new platform and format, the big players tell the artists, oh, we're going to lose our shirts on compact discs or DVDs or streaming. They say we can't possibly pay the same royalties or salary. You've got to help us. And that's what happened with streaming. And streaming isn't the future anymore. It's the present. Disney Plus, for example, just launched and immediately signed up 10 million people. That's what they say. And that brings us to this article. People are trying to negotiate, and only studios know how well their TV shows and movies are doing on those streaming services. But the guilds...
The studios don't in general. I mean, to be clear.
Oh, no, the studios only know about their own mysterious accounting methods.
Well, in
terms of whether a movie's profitable or not.
Well, but not a movie on the platform.
No.
I mean, in the way, if you're Sony Studios and you made something for Netflix,
I'm talking about their own streaming service. You know, I'm talking about their own. I'm talking about the ones who are on their own.
That's right. Know. The ones on their. I mean, to put it just to be real clear about it, in this scenario does not just involve a creator, a director, writer, actors, crew and producer, and a streaming service. There's always a studio, whether nominal or actual studio, involved as well. The studio and the creators do not know what's going on. Only the streaming service, which you're right, in the case of Netflix, it could be that Sony is the studio for a Netflix movie or a Netflix series, or it could be that it's produced under the auspices of Netflix itself.
Right, and Universal will do the stuff for Peacock and some of them.
And Disney for Disney and so forth. That's right. But there are some, Lionsgate and Sony most notably, and probably to some extent Paramount, there are some agnostic third-party suppliers. And they're as in the dark as the others.
Oh, right, absolutely.
Right? I mean, they get a premium. So they instead of having to partially finance a series themselves, the way Sony would have if it was making something for CBS back in the day, let's say, Netflix says to Sony, we will pay you your production costs plus, say, 30%. That's the deal they reach, let's say. And that's all you get. You don't get any back end. You don't get any information about how well or poorly the show does. Doesn't matter to you. You're going to get your 30%.
And if it goes four seasons, you're going to get a big jump in what we pay you, but we're going to cancel most shows after three seasons.
Exactly. Exactly. And then Sony, in turn, makes a deal with the creators, with the writer, the director, the actors. And those deals, similarly, you know, do not have a true back end to them because there is no more back end in this scenario. And the reason there's no more back end is the following. Back in the day, before streaming, you make a show for Sony, or rather, you make a show for CBS. Sony makes a show for CBS. The show airs on CBS, and then when it's done on CBS, Sony sells it into syndication or into cable, and they sell home video, they sell foreign rights.
And all over the world, yeah.
All sorts of aftermarkets, that's right. And that's where, if a show was really successful, you could make just boatloads of money, to the point that in a few cases, individuals became not just millionaires, but even billionaires by virtue of being showrunners on shows that were that successful. But with the streamers, with Netflix in particular, and with Disney Plus, you sell all rights worldwide in perpetuity. So there is no aftermarket that the studio, the Sony in this example, gets to control. Netflix owns everything for the rest of time and throughout all geography. And then you start asking, well, you know, if a show does really well for Netflix, we, either Sony or we, the actor, director, writer, would like to get some semblance of that success, some bump. And Netflix says, you know, we don't really release metrics. We'll release a little bit every now and then if it suits us. But, you know, you have no data to build renegotiation on top of, other than the fact that it got renewed, season renewal. Yeah. Exactly. And or that it won some awards. And the whole thing collapses in terms of both in terms of back end in individual negotiation and in parallel residuals. How do residuals work in streaming? In general, they're based on a fixed dollar amount. It's one payment per year. It declines year by year. And it also, that pay, the actual amount of the payment is also based on the size of the platform. In the season, at the time that that particular season aired. So even if the platform gets bigger over time, it doesn't count. And the fact that your show, you know, did better than someone else's show in terms of viewership, however you measure viewership, which is itself a thorny question, does not affect the residual. And that's something that the guilds are very uncomfortable with.
Yeah, and this was fascinating to me. I didn't realize this, but of course I should have. The guilds use ratings and box office to determine residuals, upfront payments, baseline salaries, and so on to a degree. No?
No, no.
A network show gets more than basic cable, which gets more than some 10-minute digital thingy, though, right?
No. The way residuals in linear television, conventional television work is...
Well, everything, not just residuals. I'm talking about upfront payments, salaries, everything, all these different things.
No, none of those things are based on ratings. And as far as the guild minimums are concerned, the guild minimums are in a book and they are what they are. You know, for a day player, it's about $1,050, for example, today.
But isn't it different for a primetime show versus cable, basic cable versus HBO versus, you know, a syndicated show versus...
For writers and directors, it varies, but not based on ratings, just based on what kind of platform.
Right, and for actors, yeah.
For actors, it does not. For actors, that the day player gets $1,050, whether you're talking about a basic cable show, an HBO show, a Netflix show, a CBS show, any of those. It's the day player gets $1,050. The weekly player, you know, again, these are the minimums, the minimum in the union
right.
agreement. The weekly player gets something like 4,000 or so, roughly, you know, yada, yada. It's not based in any way on the ratings or on, you know, this or on the size of the cable network. And likewise, the residual in the case of network is based on, you know, basically based on minimums. In the case of sales into cable, for example, from a network show, it's based on the license fee, but it's not based on ratings. Ratings have never factored into directly into residuals or in any computational way.
But this is actually drawing to a big, what I liken to a perfect storm. And that is all of the guild contracts need to be renegotiated over the next 12 months.
Six months.
Well, okay, even they worse. Expire, better, somebody better get on it.
Yeah, I mean, the Writers Guild contract expires May 1st. And the Screen Actors and Directors contracts expire June 30th. The Directors Guild normally would be in negotiation in next month, in a few weeks. They'd be in informal negotiation now and formal talks next month. But we've been told not to expect formal talks until sometime after the new year. The holdup is, in fact, this residuals issue.
And this is a shocking change. And we should be done by now. And instead, they haven't even started. And the DGA really sets the table for a lot of other people, typically, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Not done by now. They would normally be done in
by December,
mid December. Yeah. That's right. But they do set they do normally go first, and through a phenomenon called pattern bargaining, they do set the table, as you put it, for the other unions, typically. So there is the real prospect of a writers and or actors strike and or a dual strike, both of those unions being out on strike for the first time. We would have a concurrent strike since 1960, when residuals were largely, it was a time when residuals had been established before that, but it was a very pivotal date in the establishment of residuals.
And you made a point of commenting that SAG-AFTRA is kind of in the loop, according to at least one source, about what's going on, because, you know, they're all in this together in a way.
Yes, I mean, it's always been the case that they're all in it together, but we are told that there is somewhat greater coordination this time between SAG-AFTRA and the Directors Guild.
Do you think that the actors could actually strike at the same time, meaning there could be three guilds striking at the same time?
No, two. The directors are highly unlikely to strike. They've struck once in their 85 or 90 year history, and that was for 15 minutes. I think that what could happen would be if the directors don't manage to reach a deal with the studios, that they could step aside and say to the studios, "Why don't you start talking with the Writers Guild? Good luck with that." Which would be the implicit threat, because the Writers Guild is more strike prone than the Directors Guild and more assertive in a strike oriented way than the Directors Guild is likely to be. And at that point, if that were actually to happen, if the directors were to, you know, put talks on hiatus at some point and the studios moved to the Writers Guild, the studios, the AMPTP, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, which is the group that represents the studios, would be trying to make a deal with the writers. And the writers could walk on May 2nd, and then the actors on June 30th. And the directors would be, in that scenario, the directors would be effectively idled, even if they didn't declare a strike, because there'd be no actors to direct and no new scripts to direct, and there'd just be nothing for directors to do. You know, and that gets us, by the way, to the AMPTP that I just mentioned. And one of the complicating factors this round, as I mentioned in the article, is that the AMPTP is more fractured this time around than it ever has been.
Yeah.
And that creates more leverage for the unions on the one hand, but also a greater likelihood of strikes, because there's no single unified leadership. There's less of a unified leadership to communicate and negotiate with, and
because they don't have the same goals anymore. They're so different, right?
That's right. That's exactly it. So if you think about the studios pre streaming, and let's say pre Netflix, you know, 10 years ago, you know, and pre some of the consolidation, you know, Fox being bought by Disney and Warner's being bought by AT&T, you had a variety of studios, each of which had fairly decent market share, and each of which was in the business of making movies that then got released in theaters and also making TV shows that would go to one network or another. Some of them did have networks and they're more likely to make programming for their own network, but others didn't have networks. So they weren't, you know, uniformly the same, but they were pretty similar businesses. Fast forward to today, you have Netflix and Disney. Disney now has Disney Plus and owns Fox, and so Disney and Netflix are, you know, obviously ferocious competitors. You've got Universal, NBC Universal, owned by Comcast, which says, well, we're going to try to do this advertising-supported VOD thing called Peacock, and it isn't even out yet. And basically, they're saying we're not going to compete directly with all this SVOD, all these streaming services, in quite the same way. And you have Warner's, which is owned by AT&T, and they're going to have their
providing
service.
Sony's providing content, and Amazon just wants you to get free shipping and buy stuff on their website.
Yeah, Amazon doesn't care, you know. And Sony, as you say, providing, you know, free content for everyone, and they're all, you know, divergent in their interests and in the degree to which they care about certain issues. And the divergence also means that none of them are going to, you know, the strongest single player in the conventional entertainment industry, at least, is Disney. But they're not going to look to Bob Iger, the head of Disney, and crown him the leader the way in an earlier day, I mean, much earlier now, 20 years ago and more, Lou Wasserman of Universal was the studio mogul who dealt with the unions and was sort of the king of labor on the studio side.
Well, he's a former agent too, so that kind of helped.
And that kind of helped. He was a former agent. He was both an agent and a studio mogul at the same time at one point a long time ago. That would be in the late 50s, early 60s. You know, that kind of a personage just does not exist. And, you know, even if you grant that Iger and Disney are extremely powerful, you know, Netflix is not going to say, you know, can you see Reed Hastings or Ted Sarandos saying, oh, Bob Iger speaks for us? Well, no, I don't think so. You know, can you see AT&T, which is, you know, got his hands full, not fumbling the ball, trying not to fumble the ball with its HBO Max upcoming service? Can you see them saying, oh, well, you know, just we don't really need a seat at the table. Just listen to Bob. He can make a deal on our behalf. It doesn't play out that way anymore.
And what's fascinating here is that there's no obvious fair answer to any of these questions. Like, if you just talk about, do you link residuals to the subscriber base? Would that be accurate? Is that domestically or worldwide? Do you count subscribers who pay, you know, $15 in America the same as a subscriber who pays $4 in India? Do they count the same? Do you weigh them differently? Are you a subscriber if you get Hulu with ads for free with my Spotify account, which is what I do?
Or if you get Amazon Video and almost never watch it because you're really more interested in the one-day shipping.
Exactly.
Right. Or the music from Amazon, you know.
And then you say, would talent be better off basing it on ratings and amount watched? Or would they be better sticking with subscribers for the service overall when their show first aired? What about ad-supported free? What about a combo? Do you give more weight to the bigger number, whether it's subscribers or popularity? Not if you're the streamer that wants to pay as little as possible, but yes, if you're the talent who wants to get more money.
It becomes a multidimensional chess problem, and those are not easy to resolve. There is some feeling in labor that they want to retain the subscriber. I mean, one source, anyways, on the labor side, wanted to retain the subscriber approach, but add on a kicker for viewers. Whereas another source close to the situation said subscribers are meaningless. You should be looking at viewers. Then you've got a Netflix publicly saying viewers aren't what matters. Minutes watched is what matters. So,
and then isn't there also the whole idea of, you know, retention and attraction, meaning, right, you know, how many new subscribers did you retain or draw to the platform?
Because of my show, right. My show dropped on Netflix. All 10 episodes of the first season of my big show drop on Netflix. And guess what? Netflix gets a bump of 100,000 subscribers, let's say.
And the show was great.
Thank you. If there were one, or let's say, you know, that people who engaged with my show, who watched most episodes, 3 months later, the most of those people are still subscribers at a much higher rate than the average Netflix subscriber. In other words, my show reduced what's called churn, C-H-U-R-N, churn. It helped Netflix retain subscribers. Think about, you know, you want an example of that? Think about Game of Thrones and HBO. How many people subscribed to HBO and stuck with it because of Game of Thrones? An awful lot of people. If that's the case in a streaming service, though, there's no mechanism for the show to get the benefit of that or the show's creators.
And, you know, that's what the article emphasizes, this black box of knowledge. Nobody except the people in charge know about ratings or any of this churn or anything that's going on. And as you say, credible viewership data would seem useful to agents and attorneys too, helping them make the case for more lucrative compensation or providing a structure for bonuses analogous to theatrical box office bonuses that could take the place of disappearing back-end participations. I mean, the fact is, no one's ever going to see those Friends numbers again, are they?
No one's going to see those numbers again. And as one of my sources said to me, good luck seeing the new numbers, the actual success metrics. And interestingly, as you saw from the article, although two sources agreed that having this kind of data would be helpful in crafting bonus structures and negotiating for better compensation, two other sources, one an attorney and one an agent, disagreed and said that you're better off not knowing, because these shows actually, they think, They're not drawing much. They don't draw so many people. So I'd rather point to the fact that, you know, that this show was a hit for you guys and then got the, you know, 5 Emmy nominations and 2 Emmy wins or 10 Emmy, whatever it is. And be arguing on that battlefield rather than have the service come back and say, yeah, it got Emmys, but it didn't get viewers.
Yeah, with the Emmys and Emmy and Globe nominations being linked to deal points, surely the guilds want the Emmys to expand to 10 in every major category.
They probably would, although the guilds do not link Emmys and Globes.
No. But because the directors can get more money, they want their guild, the GA, to say to the Emmy people, for the love of God, expand to 10. Then more people get a nomination.
Yeah, that'd probably be the case. Although that's it's seen as having more of an effect on overscale compensation, which the guild itself doesn't negotiate. So it's a little bit attenuated.
Now, the SAG-AFTRA already signed an exclusive deal with Netflix. Does that establish any metric or standard that people are going to use, or is that its own weird category for some reason?
It's not even a weird category so much. It's fairly similar to pretty much really the same in many ways, I think, as the residual structure already. In fact, if I'm remembering correctly, in most ways, it is the existing residual structure that I described. But what's significant about it is that it's chronologically desynchronized from the other deals. So the SAG deal with Netflix started this year, this July, I believe, and goes for 3 years. So it does not expire next year. So for SAG-AFTRA, what expires in June 30th of next year is their deal with the conventional studios and Amazon, but not their deal with Netflix, which would give SAG-AFTRA the scenario, if they were to go on strike, of going on strike against Disney Plus and the other conventions, but not against Netflix. Now, how would Bob Iger what would he think about that?
We want to keep seeing The Crown, you know? We don't want to miss a season.
Well, I mean, and Iger would rather have you miss a season and have you come to Disney Plus. So it's a very potentially painful situation for Disney Plus to be in, to know that it's... That Netflix can be leveraged against it, at least by the Screen Actors Guild.
Well, I highly doubt that this will be the last time we speak to you about this kind of
weeks into the WGA strike, people said, wow, it's dragging on. We're like, are you kidding me? This is going to go on. They're talking about structural changes to the entire industry. This is going to last a year, if not longer. This is a huge long-term problem.
It is a long-term problem. If there are strikes, let's hope they don't last a year. But
The WGA, yeah. They fired the people. It's been what? How many months now?
Oh, the agents? Yeah. Well, it's been 7 months and going. And on that, by the way, I'm skeptical that the legal cases, which they have, both in both directions against each other, I'm skeptical that those are going to lead to resolution. So
no,
that's going to continue as well.
I think they need to hire you to work it all out. And then, you know.
Well, from your lips, thank you.
Well, in the meantime, thank you for joining us to kind of help us sort it all out. Jonathan Handel, an entertainment attorney with Troop Law.
No,
and also,
Troy,
of course,
Troy Gould.
Troy Gould, sorry. I don't know. Is Troop Law even any? Did I just make that up out of whole cloth?
Pretty much.
I think I did. Yeah, okay. Well, certainly an entertainment attorney with Troy Gould and a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, it was great of Jonathan Handel to stop by and make it sound like a 1970s TV special where celebrity guests just unexpectedly, oh, look, it's Bing Crosby, you know? Oh, look, Jonathan Handel.
I just realized where Troop Law came from. It was the law firm on one of my first companies.
Oh, hilarious.
Troop Law. And it's, a big entertainment firm, or was. I don't know whether they're even still around.
Well, it was a great article. It was clear and concise, and yet it still helped me because the situation is so complicated to be able to ask him some follow-up questions and make sure I understood everything right. So I really appreciate him coming by.
Yes, as do I, and we will place links to all of Jonathan's work and his Twitter account in our show notes. That's actually
And remember, there will be no show next week.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And now our show notes, as well as ways to subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, and hopefully by the end of the week, Spotify, that can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. And it does help us when you subscribe to the show and rate and review the show on any one of those podcast aggregators. It helps other people find the show. Again, Showbiz Sandbox is our website. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us. Links to Jonathan Handel's work, links to all the stories we discussed on today's show, as well as ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. We're on Facebook, where you can like our page, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
Oh, please, it's mcclonky.com. And
oh,
yes,
God.
It is available.
It is available? You should definitely... Well, first of all, how do you spell it? Aren't there differing versions of how to spell it?
Well, you know, you could do the subtitling, but that wouldn't give you an accurate spelling. Since it's a word we've never heard before, who knows?
No, okay.
We'd have to ask George Lucas, what the hell is McClonky and how do you spell it?
If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on McClonky.com, no matter how it's spelled, why not head on over to MichaelGiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.